This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 28th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Culture with Robert Bound is brought to you in association with the Spanish Tourist Office. Hello and welcome to the 68th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. We've got a neat mix of stuff on today's show, we think, and so we hope that you enjoy a programme that has no specific theme, but we did this week get slightly starstruck by the icon of a documentary film, got happily tripped out by a wonderful musician, and got a snowball thrown down its collar at the Sundance Film Festival in Utah. Sitting comfortably? Then I will begin. Here's what's in. We meet Jackie Siegel, the irrepressible Queen of Versailles, on her rise from engineer to beauty queen to wife of a billionaire to documentary royalty. She is the Queen of Versailles.
It's easy to look at it now and have it seem like we knew what would happen, but actually, when things started to go bad, we never dreamed how bad things would get.
We'll get strung out and strummed out with the folk rock wizard Devendra Banhart. What an honour to have him on the show.
When you sit down and make an album, it's just always going to be different, for me at least. I've never recorded an album in the same place under the same circumstances.
Plus, we'll find out how this year's Sundance went down, we'll ask how a sculptor and painter collaborate together, and soak up 60 seconds of sound from Davos. That's all here on Culture, with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. First of all, you know how it works. We're going to play a song. This from Devendra Banhart's Midori House session recorded last week here at Monocle HQ. This is from the new album called Mala. It's out on March the 12th. This track is called Never Seen Such Good.
I've never seen such good things go so wrong. And everywhere we turn, they're playing our song. No, 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 no. La la la. I should have known someone so much like me would give me hell and send me to my knees. Whoa, 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 whoa. La la la. But love, you're a strange fella, show leave your mark indelibly. Love, you're a strange fella, won't you leave your mark on me? Oh, oh no. If we ever make sweet love again, I'm sure that it will be quite disgusting. Race to the end, race to the end. The memory of a ceremony so empty, bitter, boring, and hollow. Love, you're a strange fella, sure leave your mark indelibly. May as well be forever, love, won't you come and punish me? No, no.
You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now we're going to turn our attention to an exemplary documentary on many critics' best of lists at the end of last year and now out on DVD. The Queen of Versailles is a modern-day morality tale about one of America's richest men building the biggest house in America based on that titular Palace of Versailles in France. Hubris knows no bounds, you might think, and you'd be right. But David Siegel, and especially his amazing wife Jackie, come over as surprisingly human figures in this story of largesse. The gift for the filmmaker, Lauren Greenfield, is that halfway through filming, the Siegel's world is turned upside down by the financial crisis, requiring Midas and his wife to downsize considerably. So it's with great pleasure and slight trepidation that I welcome Lauren Greenfield and Jackie Siegel, the Queen of Versailles herself, to The Culture Show.
We never sought out to build the biggest house in America. It just kind of happened.
It's bigger than the White House.
2 tennis courts.
30 bathrooms.
Full-size baseball field.
10 kitchens.
Antique furniture.
90,000 square feet.
Oh, my God.
No, that's not my room. That's my closet.
No way.
This story came out of my long-term photography project on wealth, and I had been photographing both the boom and then the bust. And so by the time they had to put this incredible dream house on the market, I had seen this story happen in many other places in the world. So it was very symbolic and compelling.
Tell me about the kind of journey you went on, possibly that we don't necessarily see on screen, but between the two of you.
I mean, I think that the thing that made possible the film is the incredible access and kind of open-heartedness of Jackie. That was something that was always there. The first time I met her, I went down to photograph, and she invited me to stay in her home. I had photographed her in Beverly Hills. I met her.
She had some spare rooms, I hear.
Yeah, I met her at a party with Donatella Versace, and you know, I said, she told me about building the biggest house, and I said, I want to come photograph, and she said, come, and I was in Florida, and you know, it was that side of Jackie's character that attracted me in the beginning, because she didn't have the kind of snobbishness or aloof kind of protection that often comes with great wealth. She still was herself and was very open. And I think the extraordinary thing about David and Jackie and their family is they opened their doors when things were great, but they kept them open when things got hard. And we actually never had to have that discussion. We often discussed how the movie was changing. You know, what it started out as the biggest house in America building, the house goes on the market. We talked about what does that mean for the film. But they never said, oh,
they never said, actually, we've got to stop filming here. We need to have a check.
And that was really extraordinary. I mean, I think that was the part that was so amazing about them, is their ability to live their lives completely candidly in front of the camera. And that's a rare thing.
That's probably a documentarian's dream, you know, to have the doors open.
Yeah, that's an amazing,
I mean, of course, it's a 26,000 square foot house, so a 5-person crew can become more of a fly on the wall than in another situation, but it's really about their characters.
But by the end of the 3 years, my husband, he started getting agitated.
Well, I included
which shows up at the end of the movie.
I included a little bit at the end of the film because I thought it was important to kind of show that it was getting really hard and painful for David at the end. And I mean, he fought until the bitter end. He, even the day he ended up having to give up Las Vegas, he was working on keeping it until the early hours of the morning. He is a fighter. He never gave up. And I was documenting that. And I don't think either of us ever thought he would actually lose this building in Vegas that was his lifelong dream and his legacy.
But it is that tough thing, as you were saying, Jackie. I guess you and David probably had to have a moment, have to have a chat while the cameras weren't rolling to decide if you wanted to have Lauren's team still in your house during the filming of this thing. Did you guys talk about that?
We didn't really talk about it. I kept inviting her over.
Okay. When this crash happens and you're shooting the film and you've already presumably shot a lot of stuff and it's about Jackie and David and the family and it's about this, you know, humongous house, when it's kind of the sort of shit started hitting the fan financially, did you secretly, or rather blatantly, kind of think, did you rub your hands together and go, this is going to make an amazing film? I've got to hang in here. You must have thought that.
I thought it was really unexpected, and I think that was interesting just because it was a crisis and to see how everybody handled it, but it wasn't like I was happy that they were going through hard times. You know, I think when you're a documentarian and you're covering this, what you're happy about is that you can continue filming and continue telling the story. And I was happy that they trusted me to keep me in the mix and continue filming it. And it could have ended up with him saving the day, which I think is what we kind of thought it would end up, or what ended up happening, which I think turned into a more compelling morality tale that David, as Jackie says, has learned from too, and I think we all can learn from. So, you know, when you're in the midst of it, you're just trying to keep the cameras rolling and capture the story, whatever it is. You know, at the, it's easy to look at it now and have it seem like we knew what would happen. But actually, when things started to go bad, we never dreamed how bad things would get. And I think I didn't realize until the house went on the market, which was totally unexpected, on a trip where I just went down to film a birthday party. When the house went on the market on that trip, David revealed that he had never taken any money off the table and had put everything into the company. Well, that's very rare for a billionaire to not diversify at all and have everything staked on that one company. And that said a lot about his faith in the company, his propensity to gamble on himself and on the company, and the stakes in the game. And in a weird way, the stakes were like somebody who overreached on their middle class house because the debt was bigger than the assets.
We're in line to do $1 billion in sales for the year. We're on top of the world. And it came to a screeching halt.
The market fell over 700 points.
I would say it's touch and go right now.
We don't talk about financial problems. I guess I'll have to watch the movie to find out what's going on in my life.
And there's a nice moment in the film where you go back to New York State and you meet some of your old buddies. Some of them as well are having some problems with paying their mortgages and stuff on their houses. That's a kind of nice moment in the film. I mean, do you get up there much? Do you kind of go back? Or have you started going back since maybe the money thing brought you down to reality a little more?
Well, I wouldn't say I ever was out of reality. I always believe, don't forget where you came from, you know? And I think that's one thing that's kept me humble. And I just like people for who they are. I don't have to have rich friends. I still am friends with my high school girlfriends.
Because Lauren was saying that she met you originally, it was to do with the Donatella Versace shoot, your other career as a photographer. Presumably it came through that.
You know, what was so amazing when we went to the hometown, which really impacted me in a way, I kind of went there on a lark, not knowing if it would make its way into the film. It turned out to be really important for two reasons. One is, one surprise is that Jackie's an engineer and she worked at IBM. I mean, in the beginning of the movie, she's with a man 30 years her senior. He's a billionaire. She's beautiful. To know that she's really brilliant, too, I think changes the way you see her choices. And the other thing was the fact that she was as comfortable. She actually stayed with one of her girlfriends in Binghamton. And the fact that she was as comfortable in a little house like the one she grew up in and sitting at the table with her old friends as she was in the potential Palace of Versailles. And that was... It also reminded me of how she kind of seamlessly could go from McDonald's to caviar, from Versace
That's
to Walmart.
That's one of the most amazing things in the film we see.
Maybe I should put caviar on my cheeseburger.
Exactly.
Get the best of both worlds.
There's a nice moment when there's two nice moments when you're unwrapping Christmas gifts in the film and you have bought yourself a present, which is a big sort of jar of beluga caviar. It looks like the good stuff as well.
It was
very dark and inky and delicious. And your husband has bought the Hershey bar, which I think was which is a sort of an allusion to his mother or his grandmother.
Right, when your mother didn't have any.
Yeah, and there seem to be two really beautiful moments in the film that you've kind of almost bought yourself the two gifts. There's a huge Christmas tree strewn with bicycles and expensive things that you've gone shopping for. And it kind of comes down to these two lovely gifts. There's a lot of compulsive purchases, though, not just of this huge Palace of Versailles. There's an amazing shopping trip where you're... I don't know which store you're in, but...
We were at Walmart.
Okay.
Yeah. And, it makes me... I am a little bit compulsive, but I'm more like a power shopper. Like, I don't like to waste time.
I'm a little bit compulsive, but I'm a power shopper.
Like, I don't like to spend all day shopping. Like, I'm in and out.
And in Jackie's effort to downsize, she re-gifts old gifts to David for Christmas. And I had the opportunity to show
them. That's very, very thrifty. I
showed the film to the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development and the whole HUD department in Washington. And afterwards, the Secretary of Housing said that was his favorite moment when David opens this game of the children's game of Risk and says, Risk? What's risk?
Yes, exactly. I know. Yeah. That was something I wrote. These are the notes I was making when I was rewatching the film on DVD at the weekend.
So that's when you take over the world.
Yes, exactly. And before we go, it would be nice to know...
What's happening to the house?
Well, there are two things. What's happening to the house? But first, we've talked about the fact that you didn't really necessarily moderate your behaviour or have to... Well, you could very relaxed around the cameras. But was there anything that you kind of did in secret that you had to do in secret? Because it's a pretty kind of warts and all documentary, isn't it?
There is one thing, but she can't say what it is.
Because
it was done in secret.
I basically asked you to come in and tell me your secrets.
Oh, what's my secrets? I did the plastic surgery stuff on there.
Yes, and this is
maybe some of my vices. I don't know.
Some of your vices. So tell me what's happening with the house.
Well, the good news is we started construction back on the house. My husband, he really didn't want to sell the house, but he put it on the market. So he decided he's going to finish it, whether we live there or we sell it. But he really wants to live there. I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it. But I don't think
Radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place. We can put your email address on this.
I'll give you a commission.
That was Lauren Greenfield and Jackie Siegel, director and star of The Queen of Versailles. The DVD is out in the UK today. It'll be released soon in Australia, and you can already pick up a copy if you're in the US or other parts of Europe. So that was the film that made waves at last year's Sundance. But what about this year? The festival just wrapped up in Utah, and next, we'll hear how it went.
With endless fiestas, festivals, and carnivals, you can choose between the legendary nightlife of never-sleeping cities such as Madrid, Barcelona, and Ibiza. Discover why fiesta is a Spanish word and join in the celebrations. Visit ineedspain.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Each year when the snow begins to accumulate in the Rocky Mountains in the United States and the skiers, snowboarders and snow lovers start to congregate, Park City, Utah braces for another avalanche of visitors. It's a welcome influx of filmmakers, stars, movie distributors and reporters to the Sundance Film Festival, famous for its indie credentials and its status as an industry bellwether. We sent James Nelson to get a sample of this year's festival and hear one filmmaker's ambitions for his production.
During the Sundance Film Festival, you can find all the fashion, stars, buzz, and energy that you could imagine, and mostly on one street. That's Main Street in Park City. Moviegoers shop for any extra tickets to the 119 film screening this year, or a chance to meet one of the Hollywood stars in attendance.
You look gorgeous.
Robert Redford set the table for this festival decades ago, and now it's a staple on the film calendar. It's a vital place for independent films to strike commercial deals, for storytellers, undiscovered talent, independent voices, and entertainment. They all find a home at Sundance. One film trying to get noticed this year is Toy's House, a new movie about teen rebellion, dipped in comedy and rolled out at Sundance. Tyler Davidson is the show's producer.
Our goal was just to keep audiences excited. All of our screenings were sold out, so we didn't have any problem trying to attract people to the showings. And, really the film, I think, takes care of itself.
Let's talk about it. Toy's House. Tell us the genesis and what we have on screen.
Sure. Toy's House is a comedy with a lot of heart, a really hilarious film that is moving people, I have to say. It was written by a writer named Chris Galletta, directed by Jordan Vogt Roberts. It stars a young cast, primarily Nick Robinson, Gabriel Basso, Moises Arias, but also we've got some great veteran actors like Nick Offerman, Megan Mullally, Allison Brie, and others that are supporting the cast. And it's a really great story about three young teenage boys who flee home. They're kind of tired of their home lives with their overbearing parents, and they decide they're going to go to the woods and build their own makeshift house and live off the land as would-be masters of their own destiny. So, of course, things come unglued at some point, as you might expect.
Can you share with us a little about what went into it in terms of how long and how much money you spent and I guess how it becomes successful from this point forward?
Sure. Well, we shot this film this past summer outside Cleveland, Ohio, which is where I'm from. It was a tremendous experience being able to bring a film back to my hometown where I actually currently reside. But once we finished the film, it was a race through post-production on a very ambitious schedule, I'd have to say, to try to meet that Sundance deadline. And of course, getting accepted into Sundance was a huge thrill and a lift for the film. And from here, the hope is that we match with a distributor who will then release it to an audience all over the world. And actually, we have some news that we're hoping to share in the next few days about that. So.
Last question for you, Tyler. What's on the horizon? What else is in the works with the movie industry?
Sure. Well, I'm certainly keeping busy. I'm already in pre-production on the next one, which is a sci-fi thriller that we're going to shoot mostly in New Mexico, some in Cleveland again. And that's a terrific project. And I really just don't have any downtime in this business. It's one to the next. And fortunately, we have times like this at Sundance that make it all worthwhile.
Toy's House made the rounds at Sundance and people started talking. And for this film, screenings were strong. Screenings were fabulous. The result? CBS Films acquired the movie. And so it goes. Another tale of success as the snow flies and the crowds gather at Sundance. For Monocle in Park City, Utah, I'm James Nelson.
Well, that's one film that was putting on its party dress and trying to get noticed at Sundance. But which other films were catching the attention of the critics? We caught up with Kate Arthur, LA editor of BuzzFeed, to get our picks from this year's event.
Of the things that I saw, my favorite was Kill Your Darlings, which is the Daniel Radcliffe as Allen Ginsberg movie, which just sold to Sony Pictures Classics for a good amount, so people will be seeing that sometime this year. I thought it was a wonderful movie. It just illuminates this kind of hidden story in the history of Allen Ginsberg and the Beats. Jack Kerouac is also a character. William Burroughs is a character, and it's about their time at Columbia and this charismatic figure named Lucien Carr, who ended up murdering someone else that they knew, and that's kind of the centerpiece of the movie, but it's really just this amazing period piece, 1944 at Columbia University in New York City. I just loved it.
And Daniel Radcliffe plays Allen Ginsberg in that.
Yes,
that's quite a departure. There must have been a queue around the block for a very fine young American actors to take on that role. And how did he do?
He did great. The accent alone, I mean, Allen Ginsberg was a kid from Paterson, New Jersey, and there was no hint of being British, and he really he is very brave in this movie. There's quite a sex scene. There are actually two, but there's quite a sex scene between him and a man he picks up at a bar. That's his first sexual experience with a man, and it's, you know, it's quite daring.
Is it raw?
On his part.
Daring.
Yeah, and he really, I mean, he's really broken away from Harry Potter way more quickly than I think anyone would have thought.
Okay, and what else caught your interest?
The best experience I had was seeing the Jane Campion miniseries, Top of the Lake, which will be broadcast, I believe, on the BBC, and here it'll be on the Sundance Channel, and it's a six-hour miniseries. I think broken up into seven parts, but they showed it in one big, long installment while we were there, and it was just an incredible experience. It stars Elizabeth Moss, who plays a detective. She's an actress who's, you know, on Mad Men, and it's just a wonderful, riveting, riveting drama, and I absolutely loved seeing it all at once. It was an unbelievable experience.
Well, maybe you can tell us, Kate, a little bit more about some of the distribution stories, some of the movies that sold, that there was a buzz about. You mentioned sort of Oscar nominations for Kill Your Darlings, the right. Daniel Radcliffe, Allen Ginsberg movie. What else was sort of shifting a lot of meetings this year at Sundance?
Well, the movie that will for sure be the biggest seller of the festival is a movie called The Way, Way Back, which stars Steve Carell and Sam Rockwell and an unknown kid, which was written by and directed by Nat Faxon and Jim Rash, who are both recognizable actors. Jim Rash is on Community. Nat Faxon is on a show called Ben and Kate. They also adapted the screenplay of The Descendants and won the Oscar last year, but this is the first movie that they've directed, and it sold for $9.75 million to Fox Searchlight.
There's one thing I will miss dearly. It is the...
It's
part of our tradition.
What kind of warped tradition is that? Lewis was pouring his heart out?
I was going to say people. I'll miss the people.
Stop! Oh, my goodness, you
You know, people, it got a standing ovation. People absolutely loved it. And, you know, say that it's going to turn Sam Rockwell's career into a different direction. And, you know, that might be the little miss sunshine of this festival.
Obviously, there's people that might snap up their films as soon as they walk out of the movie theater and try and do some business. But in terms of the highs and lows and the laughter and tears of an audience, they presumably tell people a lot that they need to know. Or do you think the Sundance audience is a little bit too art house, perhaps, to give a taste of what America and the rest of the world might dig?
Yeah, I think it's that last bit. I think that indie movies, there's been a real collapse in that market in general. There's maybe one or two big successful indie movies each year in terms of being big economic successes, but there isn't an indie movie audience in the way that there might have been 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when Miramax was at its height. But big movies from last year's festival, other than Beasts of the Southern Wild, you probably couldn't name them, but that doesn't mean that there weren't people who were having exactly these kinds of conversations and thinking that some of these movies would be very big movies.
And that was Kate Arthur, BuzzFeed's LA editor, giving me her picks from this year's Sundance. Still to come in part two, we'll enjoy some more of that captivating session from Devendra Banhart. We'll hear about United by Content's new business deal to distribute films across Africa. We'll ask how easy it is to form a successful artistic collaboration. And we'll get a minute of sound from Snowy Davos. So let's first get another track from that stunning Midori House session. This is Devendra Banhart, who insisted on introducing himself.
Let's hear it for Devendra Banhart, everybody. Thanks for having me here. I am a big fan, so thanks. It's cool. This next song is called Golden Girls. I was going to bed very early at this time, and my friend said, "Do you want to go out tonight?" I said, "No, I'm going to go to bed now." And he said, "What, are you a golden girl?" And I thought, that's great. What a nice thing to say. Like, I'm a golden girl. And then he said, "No, I'm talking about the TV show." And it became the name of the song. It's not really related, although titles are just as important, I think, actually, as the song itself, especially if it's an instrumental. This isn't an instrumental. Unrelated title, but somehow I think it evokes something about it, Golden Girls, but it's really a song sung to the lone youth dancing. But it actually has nothing to do with anything I just said.
And prayers that you don't believe in what's really there. You're a young man on the dance floor, a young man in a young man's world. Get on the dance floor. Get on the dance floor.
get on the dance floor. Get on the dance floor. Thank you so much.
That was Devendra Banhart in session here at Midori House last week with Golden Girls, and afterwards I sat down with the man himself to talk about what the record is, but not what it sounds like, and why Jon Bon Jovi's spandex leggings are quite so inspirational.
I do appreciate your publication.
Well, thank you very much.
I really do.
We've always appreciated your records, so it's lovely to have you in here in our space. The record is called Mala.
Yes.
And I've been told that there's two meanings of this word. I mean, sweetheart in Serbian.
Mm-hmm. Well, it means
small.
It means
bad lady in Spanish.
It actually means small in Serbian, but it's used as a colloquialism for sweetie pie. It also means, it's not just in two different languages. It means, that word is in a couple of different languages. In it's a Hindu word for smashing jacket.
Okay, really?
Or atrocious blouse. It's the Hindu word for that. And it's Sanskrit for something else. It's Greek for something else. I'm not the journalist. You do the research.
Okay, I'm going to do the research.
I'm not the etymologist.
So Mala is the name of the record. It is a beautiful thing to me. And to me, it sounds a little bit more muscular. There seems a little bit more percussion on it or somehow. When you write a record of songs, you write some songs and they end up all together on a record like that. Is that something that you decide to do to thematize things like that or give something a little bit of a stronger production?
When you sit down and make an album, it's just always going to be different, for me at least. I've never recorded an album in the same place under the same circumstances, nor have I been in the same circumstances emotionally or physically, figuratively, literally, geographically as the last record. So it's always going to be quite different. There is, of course, intent, and there's a structure, at least one that we try to adhere to, that we create, and it's based, of course, on the prior attempts by other artists that succeeded.
Yeah.
And I've never done that, which is why I keep making art. It's failure. It's this perpetual failing that keeps me making this. And that's a wonderful, that's the carrot at the end of the stick that I'm, you know, and that's fine. The farther off from the mark I fall, the more motivated I am, I think, to continue making art.
And we're yet to see the cover of this new album. Did you do the cover up?
Oh, I did.
Yeah.
I did do the cover.
Because we've got a promo CD. Sounds great, but I don't know what it looks like yet.
Oh, I'd love to show you.
Is that a pleasure is there a link between the
two? It's my responsibility to design the covers of the music.
Yeah.
The cover of the album, right? To somehow visually represent the music, but I don't they don't bleed into each other the way they did. I've had a visual art career that's ran parallel with my musical career. And I've been very fortunate to be able to keep those worlds somewhat separate. I mean, there it is.
Matthew Rankin has come in and is now showing it to us through the glass.
There we are. There you go. So that's the cover of the CD. The LP has quite a different cover.
Oh, it's good. Okay.
And so that is the CD cover of the album Mala.
I rather like it. That's a properly abstract CD sleeve. What's the LP sleeve like?
The LP is just calming. It's a little more calming and less hammy.
Did you commission yourself to do that for the CD and the LP, or did you kind of flick through some stuff you'd already done, or do you go, right, this is what this album's about, I shall now put it into a painting form for the cover?
It's really just what I'm making. That's the artwork that I'm making right now.
Okay.
So there'll be a print, and there are drawings inside. I wish I could show you more, and then it makes it much easier to even talk about. You seeing it, then to talk about it is fine.
It's tough to,
And so this is difficult, but I had made the album, and once it was done, it became clear to me that I don't want to say what the thing is like, just what the thing is from now on. At least that's the phase where I'm with the writing. So the writing, and a lot of it is inspired by Japanese poetry. They never say what it's like. They just say what it is.
Yeah.
You know, one of my favorite poems, and is a very famous Japanese poem that goes, New Year's, stars in the sky, vomit in the streets. It's an entire film, very few words.
Boom.
They managed to
Well, I'm not going to ask you about what the record sounds like, because also you've played tracks for us. We don't need to do that. But I did want to ask you, because you're over here, the record's out in March.
March 12th, I believe.
But you're over here right now doing some talking about the record, or not, talking around the record. What's that like?
It's weird, because I don't like talking out loud, yet I don't even know if I like people that much.
Oh,
but
God.
But I can, I do this, you know, I get in front of people and I sing and stuff, and I do like people, but if I, paradise sounds like withdrawing and not having to see another human being for a
but
long
what happens,
time.
You know, when we came, when the show, when you played a couple of tracks for us, everyone loved it. Everyone was in stitches. Everyone, we're going to keep that in because it was too good. All the talking stuff.
Are you sure you're,
yeah.
you're
I don't
talking
need my
to the
head
right person?
Yeah. I've
been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I thought it was someone else. I thought it was John Bon Jovi. I thought that's
what
you were
talking about. No, we were saying that you and I and John have the same...
Same spandex.
That's right.
Dealer. Same leggings dealer. Yeah.
If you do ever come across the soundtrack to Young Guns,
yeah,
it is worth looking at that photo of John. It's actually really inspiring. He's in cowboy boots and spandex, standing with a mountain behind him with a guitar. It really is actually a really incredible photograph.
That was Devendra Banhart, and his new album, Mala, is out this spring on March the 11th, in fact, and you'll be able to check him out on tour and at festivals all over the world later this year. Right now, you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Pound. United by Content are a global film distribution company who've been forging a web of international relationships in recent months. The aim is to expand the reach of where their clients, who include the likes of 20th Century Fox, Universal and Warner Brothers, can get bums on seats in cinemas in growth markets, while helping improve access to films for new audiences in various corners of the globe. They've already struck deals with local distributors Neverfilm in Russia and Accent in Singapore, and they've just announced their latest venture in Africa with WB Cape Media. Keen to hear more about where the African movie market is headed and how this deal will make an impact, culture producer Katie Bilboa sat down with director of digital cinema, Alan Christensen.
So we're in the business of helping media entertainment companies to manage and distribute their content around the world. The area I work in is digital cinema, so it's kind of working with different content owners in different territories, bringing together a more digital approach of delivering content into territories all over the world. So our primary clients are Hollywood studios, independent production companies.
So you have a range of content produced by some big studios, some independent production houses, and your
Correct.
Job is to try and get that stuff out there around the world.
Yeah, so we're working with these guys. I mean, we're sort of helping them get the content to the audiences. I mean, the whole point behind United is uniting our clients sort of with the content that they put out to the audiences. So, you know, we run through different various pipelines in the business. It's digital cinema, home entertainment, digital platforms. So everything that's kind of in the new format space of delivering content is kind of how we help our clients get to their audience, pretty much.
So let's talk about the deal that was announced this week between mm-hmm. United by Content and WB Cape Media in South Africa. Can you just explain what that deal is and also what it means for audiences and for film studios?
35mm film is obviously disappearing. So that's on the demise. And digital cinema is sort of the next, it's kind of taking over. So it's right now, it's about 80% of the world is sort of deployed digital cinema-wise. Africa is one of the more emerging markets, so the same with Latin America, a few other territories. What we've done is, because we were never in the 35mm space, we entered the world of digital straight away. We looked at the future of content delivery. The way it works is the studios our clients or the global content owners, we take their content and we distribute them out to these partners and they facilitate them locally. So therefore you're cutting out shipping, you're cutting out customs. You've got local relationships between the exhibitors and somebody in territory that actually handles the hard drive duplication of your digital cinema packages, looks after the distribution, has that whole sort of on the ground feel and the first level of support as well for the exhibitors, people, showing the films in the cinemas. We're trying to make it easier for our clients. We're trying to make it easier for the local people in South Africa, the local audiences, to get a broader spectrum of classic and quality content.
So how easy is it for the people of Africa generally to access film?
In South Africa alone, you've got 50 million people. About 20 million of those people live in townships, African townships. So for them to be able to get to the cinema, the transport, the money they've got to fork out when they get there and stuff, it's a poor country, so it's very difficult for them for these things to happen. Also, they don't get exposed. They don't see the major billboards and those kind of things due to the nature of their lifestyle. So what I think digital cinema can do in Africa, and I'd like to see this happen in the future, is It's easier to set up, you know, and it's more cost effective. So with the government looking into film as a growth in the market, potentially what could happen is you could set up cinemas in these townships and you can bring the films to the people rather than trying to get the people to the films. And I think that would be quite a nice thing. And I think digital cinema, for instance, can facilitate, you know, that kind of that kind of thing to happen. So for us as well, you know, when we meet with our clients and stuff, and we, you know, we tell them we've got, you know, these cinemas in townships and stuff, I think they'll be quite pleased. And I think that's how we can try and spread the word and maybe see if we can get something done on that side.
Yeah. How equipped are the cinemas in Africa to venture into a digital era of cinema?
There's two major chains. One of the chains signed a deal recently. I would like to think they'd be fully deployed on DCI compliant systems by the end of this year at the latest.
Sorry, just to clarify, what does DCI compliance stand for?
Digital Cinema Initiatives. It's a standardized format that was put together by the six Hollywood majors to bring standardization in digital cinema across the industry. That was introduced sort of a long time ago. And everything that is produced needs to meet spec. Otherwise, you know, you're putting features out to your audiences with the wrong light levels, with the wrong, you know, there's loads of things that come into play. So there's two circuits, like I said. One of them has started deployment. The other one is yet to sign their deal with an integrator. And I believe that they will start deploying towards the middle of this year, which means by the end of next year, well, maybe the middle of next year, you'll have full deployment on digital, which is great. I'm all for it. Like, I love 35mm. I love 8mm film. I love the colors. It's, you know, it's beautiful. But digital is just, it's great. It's so easy to work with. And it's, you know, it's a beautiful format. I love it.
So in terms of your clients, I know we don't want to talk specifically about things, but you have some really big Hollywood studios on your books, as well as maybe some more independent type studios. Presumably, if you now have a system that's more efficient and enables you to be more flexible, does that mean that you can now target certain films for certain parts of Africa where you think they might do better? Is that the idea, or is the idea just to bring more kind of big Hollywood blockbusters to the whole of Africa?
That's not the idea. The idea is not to flood the market with that kind of content. For us, honestly, we're helping with the transition. We're helping people to meet in the middle and, you know, to have a better model. You know, a model that works well for future developments. Things I will say is South Africa, for instance, is a great place for, it's a great location for shooting. It's a massive, massive location for production. It's 40% cheaper than most of the world for people to go and shoot there. There's big studio lots. So a lot of Hollywood content is shot in Africa. A lot of big films, Blood Diamond, I mean, you know, the list goes on. There's tons of films that were shot in Africa and released to the rest of the world. So I think they're quite keen on Hollywood content, but I don't necessarily think it'll flood the market. Things I think that will sort of become more popular in the market as this whole thing evolves is social, cultural events and political events, the realistic events of Africa and the way the continent is. It's a rich continent with, there's so much to discover. So I think, I like to think a lot of those kind of things will start coming into the market. And also, like Tsotsi, for instance, I'd like to see that come back this way, you know, come back into the international market, sold at film festivals and, you know, make its way into countries that have never even heard of Africa.
And that was Alan Christensen, Director of Digital Cinema at United by Content. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll ask how artists collaborate when one's a painter and one's a sculptor. Chalk and cheese, artistic egos at dawn, or a marriage made in heaven?
On the slopes of Barcelona's Montjuïc Hill lies the most comprehensive museum honouring the life and work of Spanish artist Joan Miró and the Surrealist masters. Get a fresh perspective on the city and the art world when you visit the Jackson Pollock exhibition this February. Visit spain.info.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. In the last decade, artist collaborations have moved into the mainstream as practitioners pool their skills in an attempt to make original and interesting works, but also broaden their commercial reach. A pair of London-based upcoming artists and former companions at the Slade School of Fine Art have decided to do just that. British-born Nick Hornby is a sculptor who produces large-scale abstract works which have previously been exhibited in Greece, India, at iBeam in New York, and Tate Britain here in the UK. Of Balinese descent, Cinta Tantra specialises in oil-on canvas and landmark painting, and you can see an example of this on a railway bridge in central London. Their latest collaboration has just opened in the lobby at 1 Canada Square, Canary Wharf's most iconic building. So how do a sculptor and a painter work together? What do their combined efforts actually look like? We sent Jack Phillips down to Nick's studio to meet the pair and see the works before their unveiling.
My name's Cinta Tantra and I'm an artist living and working in London. I went to the Slade and then the Royal Academy. I work on an architectural scale using colour and abstract forms to wrap around buildings.
I'm Nick Hornby. I'm a sculptor based in London and New York. I make things that range in scale from a small intimate portrait bust to quite monumental 4 or 5 metres. Up until now, everything's come out white, but I think the future is colourful.
We're at Nick's studio in London's West End, and I'm surrounded by a series of large-scale, jagged sculptures. Covered in a patina of pastel colours, these monolithic and almost archaic-looking pieces tower over the artist who created them. The studio itself is a palatial and airy space.
It's so impregnated with narrative, it's almost impossible to move. Opposite us was where David Hockney and Peter Stassinger used to live in the 70s. So Peter is the boy who used to dive into the swimming pool, the bigger splash. And I think that represents sort of the epitome of the muse, the artist's fantasy. We've got a Gothic fireplace, some Gothic battlements, some mottled exposed brickwork and yellow plaster. It's all fake, behind which is breeze blocks. So we're making sort of meta-modern hybrid sculptures in a faux Gothic church-like building opposite our greatest painter where he used to live and his muse. It's very surreal.
Collaborations have their pitfalls. Spending long hours in a studio together can do harm to even the strongest of relationships. So why have the pair chosen to do this?
This is risky business, yeah? Making sculptures is quite expensive. We both have been working independently and developing audiences for quite distinctive styles of things. So to come together is potentially, we're just digging ourselves a grave. There are lots of collaborative art practices out there, and who knows what happens behind closed doors. But here we've sort of revealed our voices as very separate. The objects are a mine. The wraparound is essentially Cinta.
And where do these forms come from? Because some of them are rather abstract, but we have an almost phallic type thing over here and a very sort of archetypal arch type thing, which obviously is very pragmatic for walking around, walking through and walking under. And then we have something which looks very much like sort of a Russian futurist neck and shoulders type thing. I mean, where do these shapes come from?
So Jack, of course, I'm going to turn this back around onto you, because the whole point of these works and our practice is that we want the works to unfold and to reveal their sources. So come with, let's go on a journey. That's the silhouette of Brancusi's rooster. Amazing sculpture carved in marble in the, I don't know, early 20th century. If you walk around at 30 degrees here, snapping into view, hopefully you can make out, again, very clearly, the legs and body of a figure, which is Rodin's Walking Man. That's currently in the V&A bronze sculpture. And around again at 60 degrees, you see a very iconic sculpture that was in MoMA for a long time, which is Barnett Newman's only object, a broken obelisk. These are hybrid sculptures, or tribrid, as Ossian said. As you walk around them, you see a whole selection of 20th century iconic sculptures.
How does that work for you in terms of the colours and the way you wrap around something which is visually iconic in its physicality?
I work quite intuitively, I think, with colour. I really enjoy that kind of gut reaction that one has about colour, very childlike, I guess, which I often feel is lost when you start learning about colour theory, perhaps. And in the same way that Nick has stories about certain shapes and certain art objects, I have stories and narratives in my head about certain colours and what they remind me of. So if I'm looking at the sculpture in front of us, and for me, I think this green really reminds me of daydreaming kind of 1930s Art Deco.
The works on display are influenced by the likes of Rodin, Calder and Newman. Nick and Cinta draw influences from classical and canonical artists, but feel this shouldn't define their work.
That's not the point. I can't bear artworks that have this sort of smug puzzle to them. The viewer's never going to get our references or why we do it, but I think they do still vibrate with things that can be drawn from it, which is maybe a sort of a high-level abstraction.
The exhibition is being held in the lobby of One Canada Square, Canary Wharf's most iconic building. In the current climate, this diversification of how and where works are displayed is essential for emerging artists.
Neither of us ever for a second thought that we had worked together. We weren't even friends up until a few years ago. We thought that each other's practices were ridiculous. But having someone else's input distances you from the work a lot, and it gives you this criticality so you can step back and see it clearly.
And I think sort of taking that, working directly with the objects, there's a sort of more honesty, I think, with some of these pieces.
A painter and a sculptor producing collaborative works is intriguing and plays with ideas of authorship and ownership. It may also be one way of matching a market which is weaker than it was in the 90s, when if a Brit made it, it got sold. But the brutality of the sculpture and the almost nostalgic painterly narrative prove that stepping outside one's comfort zone can prove visually fruitful.
Jack, right. you're a painter. We've seen some of your work. What are your thoughts on these things?
I'll turn this off.
For Monocle, in London, I'm Jack Phillips.
Well, to end the programme today, we're off to the World Economic Forum in Davos. I know, an unlikely topic for us here on The Culture Show, but we know on which side our bread is buttered. Listeners to Monocle 24 will know that Midori House was broadcast live from Davos for 2 days last week. If you missed it, you can hear it again on iTunes or monocle.com. But aside from the suits, the skiing and the politics, what does that place sound like? We put this question to our team who travelled there, and they sent us back this minute of sound.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Midori House on Monocle 24, live from the World Economic Forum in Davos, with me, Steve Bloomfield.
That was a minute of sound from the World Economic Forum in Davos, and that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be visiting the 50th anniversary conference of American TV execs in Miami, and we'll gather with execs of another kind, music industry ones, at Midem in Cannes. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. My producer was Katie Bilbauer, and Holly Fisher mixed the show together with her magic gloves on. Time for one final song this week from the new album Mala. This is Devendra Banhart with Für Hildegard von Bingen. Thanks for tuning in.
Left the abyss, suffocation. She's been dreaming. Reload.